From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a result of advances in medicine and armor, wounded soldiers in Iraq are surviving with injuries that in previous wars would have killed them. That means they're living with more pain. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about innovations in treating the pain of battlefield injuries with Dr. Trip Buckenmeyer, chief of the Regional Anesthesia and Pain Management Initiative at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Also, we meet this year's recipient of the Pulitzer Prize for Editorial Cartooning, Nick Anderson of the Louisville Courier-Journal. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the British band The Pretty Things, which spun off from the early Rolling Stones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Doctors often make medical breakthroughs while treating the casualties of war, the wounds, shattered limbs, and mutilations caused by bombs, explosions, gunshots, and burns. My guest, Dr. Trip Buckenmeyer, is treating the extreme pain of soldiers injured in Iraq and is testing ways of dealing with pain that he hopes will also help civilians. One of the questions he's investigating is whether effective pain control on the battlefield leads to a better outcome in a soldier's recovery. Dr. Buckenmeyer is the chief of the Regional Anesthesia and Pain Management Center at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. My impression is that because of advances in battlefield medicine and in protection armor on the battlefield, that soldiers are surviving injuries that would have killed them in the past, and that they are therefore, in many instances, surviving with more excruciating pain. Would you agree with that?
I think that's a very accurate statement. One of the advances in this current conflict is the fact that the evacuation chain has been such a success in taking soldiers who otherwise in previous conflicts probably would not have survived, are now able to survive, and that's been a tremendous advantage for a lot of these guys. But what it does mean is from point of injury, meaning from the moment that they sustain an IED attack or a improvised explosive device attack or some other injury from a gunshot wound, they can literally expect to only take about 24 to 48 hours before they'll show up at what we call a level four facility, which would be a hospital like Walter Reed. And in this case, it's actually Landstuhl, Germany. So that's really changed the nature of how we take care of these guys.
How much time have you spent in battlefield conditions?
For the time that I was in Iraq, it was for this demonstration project, and that was 3 months.
And what is the range? What were the typical injuries that you were seeing there?
Most of the injuries were extremity wounds, and that's been a truism of this conflict because of the advances in helmet technology and body armor. A lot of the lethal injuries result from a penetrating wound to the head, chest, or abdomen, we don't see as much. So most of the casualties we were seeing were extremity wounds. But very true was that when we would get a penetrating wound to the head, chest, or abdomen, wounds that I think probably wouldn't have survived in the past, we were salvaging those soldiers. We had the resources and the equipment available.
Before we talk specifically about the techniques that you're using to treat pain, let's just talk about the degree of pain that we're talking about when we're talking about battlefield injuries. And from reading a little bit about your work, it sounds not only do the injuries themselves cause a lot of pain, but there's this almost cyclical nature of pain. So that if you have a terrible injury, that even putting in an IV line is going to create an unbearable amount of pain. Could you talk about that phenomenon?
Absolutely. It's a phenomenon we call wind-up. And the best way to describe it for you is you've probably stubbed your toe in the past, like just about everybody has, and it hurts. And it hurts that day, but the next day when you wake up, it hurts much more. And that's the phenomenon we call wind-up of pain. Now, that's a protective mechanism. Your body doesn't want you to re-injure that area, and that's great when you stub your toe, but when you've been the victim of an IED explosion and you've lost your foot, you can see how that those protective mechanisms, these feedback pathways that the body has to deal with pain, can become counterproductive for the soldier. And what we find, if their pain has not been adequately controlled by the time they get to us at Walter Reed, that very simple procedures that most people would find relatively benign, like an IV catheter placed in a vein, most people would tolerate that without any problems. But a soldier whose sensorium has been bombarded by these pain signals for so long, these pain signals that the body's not really designed to handle, a procedure as simple as that becomes an exercise in agony. So what we are trying to do is to attenuate those signals through a multimodal approach to analgesia, and regional anesthesia is a very powerful tool, but just one tool that we apply to try to provide a pain picture for these soldiers that prevents this phenomenon of wind-up. The other thing that we're concerned about with this wind-up phenomenon is that it may lead to more chronic pain syndromes, such as a more severe phantom limb pain, or complex regional pain syndrome.
Yeah, you mentioned phantom pain. That's, for example, if somebody's foot is blown off or amputated, the body can still create a sense of pain in that no longer existing foot. That would be phantom pain.
Well, as the brain tries to adjust to this new reality, unfortunately, we feel that aberrant pain pathways, if you will, get established. The soldier's lost his foot. He's getting the nerve endings at that area are bombarding the brain with these signals, and the spinal cord's trying to modulate this. Now, please understand the things we're talking about now. Our understanding of pain in medical science is really in its infancy, in my opinion. And we're just beginning to understand some of the modulating factors that go into the plastic changes that happen in the brain that lead to these chronic pain syndromes. But we feel if the brain isn't subjected to those signals, and that's one very powerful thing that a regional technique can do, it essentially attenuates or even turns those signals off. Well, if the brain's not having to be bombarded by these signals, then the bad changes that we feel are happening in the patient that lead to these unfavorable outcomes, maybe we can impact on those positively.
My guest is Dr. Trip Buckenmeyer. He's chief of the Regional Anesthesia and Pain Management Initiative at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Let's talk a little bit about the technique that you are continuing to develop and perfect. It's called regional anesthesia. Now, we all know what anesthesia is, and we kind of know what regional anesthesia is, but why don't you just kind of explain the basic concept?
Well, regional anesthesia is a technique that's actually been around for a very long time. And these techniques we haven't really developed at Walter Reed. What we've done uniquely at Walter Reed and with the Army Regional Anesthesia and Pain Management Initiative is apply these techniques in the austere military medical environment. And that's sort of what we've done that's special. But essentially, as the name implies, regional anesthesia provides analgesia and anesthesia to a region of the body as opposed to a general anesthetic, which puts the entire body to sleep. But that's a misnomer. You'll hear that oftentimes from my patients. I want to be put all the way to sleep. I don't want to feel anything. But the issue that the patients that say that are missing is that with a general anesthetic, all we're really doing is putting your frontal lobes to sleep. Your body is still responding to the pain, and in fact, your body still has a stress response to the surgical stimulus that's being applied to them. Regional anesthesia has the advantage that we can attenuate those signals or many times prevent those signals from reaching the brain, and we also know that when we do that, we can reduce that stress response.
Can you give us an example of a battlefield injury in which you've used this type of pain management catheter? And just tell us a little bit about how you developed using this in a war setting.
Well, I think the one that comes to mind most often is Brian Wilhelm, and he is a name I'm going to use because he allows me to use his name and his story in these sorts of circumstances. Brian was the first soldier that I was able to place these catheters in on the battlefield. 7 October 2003 is a very important date in my organization's history because that's the day that Brian unfortunately sustained a rocket-propelled grenade injury to his calf while he was doing an ice run in one of these convoys that we hear about so often in the news. And he didn't realize he was injured at first. He actually fell out of his vehicle and returned fire before he recognized that he had this very severe injury to his left lower calf. Essentially, his left lower calf was missing. And he applied a tourniquet to himself, and he came into my combat support hospital at the time in Balad, Iraq, the 21st Combat Support Hospital, where I had been sent to by the then Surgeon General, General Peak, to demonstrate that we could do this. We'd been claiming the ability, and essentially the Surgeon General said, go prove it, and that's what I was there to do, and Brian was the first one to come across my table. He was in 10 out of 10 pain. We use what's called a visual analog scale, and 0 is no pain, and 10 is the worst pain you can possibly imagine, and he'd already received I don't remember exactly, 15 to 18 milligrams of morphine. And I went up and tried to describe to him what I was going to do, and he cut me short and said, Doc, I don't care what you do, just make this pain go away. And that sounded like informed consent to me. So we took him back to the OR, and I placed what's called a lumbar plexus and a sciatic nerve catheter. And without getting too far into the anatomy, those are essentially the two major nerves that I have to block to turn off his leg for surgery. And he would go on to zero pain in about 5 to 10 minutes. And he was awake as they were getting ready to prepare his extremity for surgery. And we didn't know that his tibia, which is the bone down in your lower leg, was so damaged. And it actually snapped right there in the OR while they were scrubbing it. And it was audible. It was an audible snap. And Brian asked me what had just happened. And I told him nothing as I gave him a little bit more sedation. But it kind of demonstrates the power of these blocks, that he could actually have a fracture of his bone right there on the OR table and not even know what had just happened. And we talked to him throughout his operation, and he did just fine. But what was so profoundly important to me about this anesthetic was what happened after the operation. If you've been in this environment before, after a general anesthetic, it's usually a very somber meeting between the soldier's friends from his unit, because they're kind of sedated and not feeling very well. So the soldiers are usually controlled by a NCO, and they come in and they touch the bedside and they whisper things in their ears. Well, when Brian came out, he was alert, awake, pain-free, and they had a party going on in there in the PACU. They were excited about the fact that he was going home, that he felt good and he was pain-free. And when I say it was emotional for me, it's because it really represented the culmination of years worth of effort. And I got to believe that those other soldiers that were looking at Brian and saying, you know, if I don't get killed outright, if I come to these guys, this doesn't look so bad. And I want to believe that it helps them do their unbelievable job every day.
What state was he left in after the surgery? Did you amputate what was left of the leg?
No, at that point, they put what's called an external fixator on his leg, which is it's a bunch of metal rods that serve as the structural support for the bone, and they try to put the bone ends together while it heals. What's special about this anesthetic is that he was awake and alert and talking to me like I'm talking to you right now. With a general anesthetic, that's a very hard thing to do.
So he still has his leg?
He does not. He would go on to have an amputation. Unfortunately, the rocket-propelled grenade took away all his venous system so that blood was going to the leg but wasn't able to return. So he started to suffer from ischemic changes. And to be quite honest, the advances in prosthetic devices for amputees are such that in many cases, the soldier's better off to go on to amputation and get a device that will allow him to have greater function than to leave a essentially dead extremity, you know, hanging on the body. And Brian, despite valiant efforts to try to preserve the limb, finally came to the conclusion that this wasn't the direction that he wanted to go with his recovery and requested the amputation himself.
My guest is Dr. Trip Buckenmeyer, chief of the Regional Anesthesia and Pain Management Center at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Trip Buckenmeyer, chief of the Regional Anesthesia and Pain Management Center at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. He's treating the pain of soldiers injured in Iraq. Can you estimate how many soldiers have used the regional anesthesia technique that you're developing?
Out on the battlefield?
Yeah.
At this point, I believe we're greater than 50. Most of the soldiers that are getting this out on the battlefield are actually Iraqi wounded.
Why is that?
Because the evacuation system is so fast that we often don't have time to slow down enough to actually place one of these catheters as they're moving so rapidly through the system. Where we've actually made a greater impact right now is in Landstuhl, Germany, where that's the major point where all the soldiers from the Afghan and Iraq conflict pause, at that level 4 facility, and we've stood up a regional anesthesia acute pain section there, and we've impacted on far more soldiers through that movement. The biggest problem right now with getting this out on the battlefield is a training issue. Many of the anesthesiologists that are older and trained in more traditional anesthesia programs just don't have the skills to place many of these more advanced blocks. We're working very hard to change that. One of the things I'm very proud about of my residents is they come out with a level of expertise in regional anesthesia that is relatively rare right now, even in civilian training programs.
Do you have any sense of how long it's possible to use this kind of regional anesthesia that you've been working with without harming the patient's body? I mean, you know, we think of these things as being a kind of, you know, temporary measure to help somebody go through a particularly painful period. But say we're talking about severe chronic pain, pain that just isn't going to go away. Can somebody spend weeks, months, years with this kind of regional anesthesia?
Not with local anesthetics. Regional blocks are more of a acute perioperative technique to work with pain. Now, we will use these techniques in some patients with chronic pain to give the brain a rest, if you will. Patient has chronic regional pain syndrome, for example, which is a debilitating, little understood condition where sometimes a relatively minor injury can lead to such debilitating pain that the patient can't even use an extremity anymore. And we'll sometimes use these blocks to give the brain a pain-free interval, if you will, of about a week in a hospital setting to see if we can kind of reset the brain so that our other more traditional medications that we would use long-term in these chronic pain patients will work. But we're more acute pain, and we work within the OR and within the hospital in an inpatient setting. We have a very close partnership with our chronic pain physicians, but these two specialties are really very different. We work closely with each other, and there is some crossover in what we do, but acute pain is really a different specialty from chronic pain.
I know you're obviously concerned about treating pain because pain hurts, to state the obvious. But you're also concerned about treating pain because of the physiological response to pain that is actually damaging to long-term health. Can you talk about that response and why you want to turn that response off?
Well, as we study the effects of pain on the human organism, we're beginning to learn that it has a number of detrimental effects that we previously were unaware of. We know that untreated pain reduces immune function. We know that it results in an increase in stress hormones, an increase in catecholamine release, the drugs in your body that increase heart rate and respiratory response. My feeling is we need to stop thinking about pain as just another consequence of surgery that can't really be avoided, but begin to think of pain as a pathological process of the nervous system that needs to be dealt with and treated like any other disease process. And that's what my group and many other acute pain groups in the nation are beginning to do.
Now, you work at Walter Reed. I understand you were born at Walter Reed as well.
Yes, it was. I was born there. I got married in the chapel there. I trained there as a medical student. I trained there as a resident. I am now staff there, and my joke is often, I'll be damned if I'll die there.
So you must feel a pretty strong attachment to the place?
You know, I really do. It's an incredible institution. I honestly believe it's the only institution in the military where somebody like me and somebody like my organization would have the fertile ground to grow and flourish. One of the mandates in the institution's charter is research, and I've never gotten anything but support from Walter Reed, and we've been very appreciative of that.
Have you ever been in a situation where you've experienced severe pain and, you know, have had to deal with what you treat?
No. I would have answered differently before this conflict, but now that I've been exposed to these soldiers, I've never had pain in my life. the sorts of things that these guys are going through are well beyond my experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I really can't relate other than the experience I've gained from them, the knowledge that they've given me, I think is the best way to put it. I think I've learned more from them in the past 2 years of the conflict than I've learned from any group of patients that I've had in my career.
Well, Dr. Buckenmeier, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Good luck with your work.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Tripp Buckenmeier is chief of the Regional Anesthesia and Pain Management Center at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel Night and Day in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, this year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Editorial Cartooning, Nick Anderson of the Louisville Courier-Journal. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the band The Pretty Things, which was founded by an early member of the Rolling Stones. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Nick Anderson won this year's Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. The judges praised him for his unusual graphic style that produced extraordinarily thoughtful and powerful messages. His award-winning cartoons covered the war in Iraq, the Bush administration, Congress, and the connection between religion and politics. Lately, he's been drawing some Republicans with cheap little halos attached to their heads. Anderson will actually receive the Pulitzer at a ceremony next month. The 38-year-old cartoonist works for the Louisville Courier-Journal and has been syndicated since 1996. Nick Anderson, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you.
Let's start with one of the cartoons in the Pulitzer Prize-winning batch of cartoons that you submitted. And this is from June 9th. Would you describe it for us?
Yes, the setting is in the Oval Office, and George Bush is sitting at his desk, and on his desk is a memo, the infamous Justice Department memo, which says, torture justified if Commander-in-Chief deems it necessary. And there's an aide standing off to the side saying, Saddam Hussein wants to hire your lawyers.
What kind of reaction did you get to this? Were people angry that you were finding some kind of, you were making some kind of comparison between our president and Saddam Hussein?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've had to deal with that for the past couple of years. There's been a great deal of that kind of reaction, and this was just one of those many cartoons that solicited that kind of reaction, that you don't dare compare our government to those of others. And there are times when we do things that aren't particularly attractive, and they need to be pointed out.
While we're talking about a cartoon with President Bush in it, why don't you describe how you draw the president?
I generally draw him relatively small, and with big ears, and with sort of a large space between his nose and mouth. I exaggerate those features that I think should be exaggerated based on the way he looks.
Why do you emphasize the distance between the nose and the mouth?
That's what I see when I look at him.
Well, let's do it.
Are you trying to say he looks like a chimp? I bring that up as a little girl. many people have said that to me, that I draw him like a chimp.
Oh, really? No, I wasn't even thinking that. No, not at all.
That many people have said that to me.
And what do you respond?
Well, a little girl once asked me why I make him look like a chimp, and I responded, I don't make him look like a chimp. God made him look like a chimp. She didn't find that very amusing. I have a feeling I'm going to be getting some phone calls.
One of the things that really amazed me about editorial cartoonists such as you is that you not only have to have like a strong set of opinions every week, you have to take those mm-hmm. opinions and encapsulate them in a drawing with a few words mm-hmm. on it. That's really quite a gift. I'm wondering if any of the opinions you have been expressing surprise you, if you're surprised ever at your own opinions?
That's a good question. I haven't thought of it that way. Sometimes, you know, during the 90s, most of my readers, and I considered myself center-left, moderate, I gave it to both sides pretty good. And the last 4 years, I have been firing in one direction generally, and that surprises me. I don't have any regrets about that, but I think it says more about where the country has moved than it does about my own politics. My own politics haven't changed. I would say they've changed almost not at all since the mid-90s, but the country has gotten more conservative.
Now, you're syndicated, but your mm-hmm. cartoons originate in a paper in Louisville, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And how would you describe the politics of your readership in Louisville?
It's pretty mixed. I mean, the county itself went for Kerry, but the metropolitan area is probably errs a little bit more on the conservative side. The state is a red state. The city itself is pretty blue. So it's a very, very interesting and stimulating place to work, because you have very intense feelings on both sides, and you hear from both sides. It's pretty even. I would say my response from readers runs about 50-50, positive to negative.
What's the most controversial cartoon you ever did?
There was one last year. It's probably one of the more recent ones that I've done that's controversial. Coffins coming off the airplane from Iraq, and George Bush is saying to Cheney, they're looking at the coffins, and Bush is saying to Cheney, I guess their daddies didn't know the right people. And as you can imagine, that caused a lot of uproar. But I thought it was fair commentary.
Have you ever had cartoons that were killed by your editors because they thought they were, you know, it was too inflammatory, not necessarily because they disagreed with you, but because they thought the editorial was too extreme in its language or design, or in the way it spoofed or caricatured political figures?
That almost never happens. I'm lucky to have very daring editors and a very daring publisher who feel that It's better to be controversial than to be boring, and that you actually engage readers over time if you're willing to challenge them. And although they protest, they do tend to come back. And I think people, you know, the secret that talk radio seems to have discovered and that newspapers haven't is that controversy does not drive people away. It brings them in. And a lot of newspaper editorial boards are just far too safe. And I'm lucky to work at a paper where they do tend to be a little more daring. And the only time they really have an issue is when it's an issue of taste, and they think it's borderline on taste, and then we might try to clean it up a little bit. But that doesn't happen very often.
What's an example of one of those?
Well, we had one recently. The Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge, I did a cartoon. I was actually drawing it the day I found out that I'd won the Pulitzer, and I didn't have time to finish it that day, but I ended up printing it about a week later. I had a woman, a beautiful woman in a white dress, and she's wearing a sash, and it says Virgin Wilderness Territory, and there's a great big, hairy, ugly guy approaching her, and he's saying, or she's saying to him, "Is that an oil rig in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?" He's labeled big oil. So the publisher kind of winced when I showed it to him. I went straight down to his office because I knew I had to clear it at the top, and he kind of winced but laughed. And he suggested taking off the "or are you just happy to see me?" So it ended up just saying, "Is it an oil rig in your pocket, or?" And that actually cleaned it up enough that we had a few protests, but not very many. And the point of the cartoon was made without having to pull it back too much.
Why is there such a big difference if you leave out "or are you just happy to see me"? I mean, most people know that that's the punchline. Does it make it?
It leaves it to the imagination rather than making it explicit. And it for younger readers who don't know the line, they might not make the connection themselves. So that makes it, the more that you can leave to the imagination, the better, I think.
I'm sure our listeners have noticed by now that your editorial cartoons on the whole have been very critical of the Bush administration and of the Republican House. And the Pulitzers have actually been criticized by some people for consistently giving the prize for editorial cartooning to liberal editorial cartoonists. Let me actually excerpt a letter that I read on a website. We have expressed our disappointment in several respects with this year's Pulitzer Awards. Virtually every one of Nick Anderson's prize-winning cartoons is a vicious, hateful attack on President Bush, the U.S., or Christianity. There may be more virulent haters in America than Nick Anderson, but based on this collection, there can't be many. So have you had to respond to general criticisms, not only about your work, but about the Pulitzers being given to liberal cartoonists?
Yeah, just parenthetically, I looked at that website, and to the right of all that diatribe about what a hater I am, there's an ad for a T-shirt. You could buy a T-shirt that says ACLU on it, and the C, instead of being a C, is a Soviet hammer and sickle. So I guess that kind of vitriol is only objectionable when it's coming from one side. But also, the larger issue of whether the Pulitzers are awarded too often to liberals, I think it's a valid issue. I think if you look at it statistically, more liberals have certainly won. I think it's more useful to look at the portfolios that have won, and I haven't done that, but my suspicion, and I've seen many of them, but I haven't seen them in aggregate, my suspicion is that the Pulitzers are often awarded to people who are challenging those in power, who are performing a watchdog function of government, which I think is what the media should ultimately be doing. And I think conservatives tend to be more reluctant to criticize their own than liberals are. It's not that they don't do it, they just don't seem to do it with the same zeal that liberals do. And what I'm driving at is during the 90s, you had many liberals zealously going after the Clinton and Gore team. And many of them won for portfolios that were critical of the Clinton administration. So to say that it's just conservatives or conservatives are being shut out, I think it misses the point a little bit. And, I have some sympathy for those people because some of my friends are conservative cartoonists. But I think that to make the case against the Pulitzer Board, you have to look at the portfolios that have won rather than the identity of the cartoonists.
My guest is Nick Anderson. This month he won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Nick Anderson is a syndicated editorial cartoonist based at the Louisville Courier-Journal. Earlier this month, he won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. Are there mistakes that you made when you started out as an editorial cartoonist, things you were naive about, you know, that you've subsequently learned not to do?
Nothing really strikes me as naive. I would say that I've put a lot more time into the artwork the past few years than I did in my first, you know, 5 or 6 years at the Courier-Journal, because I kind of remembered why I got into this. I used to spend most of my day trying to think of the perfect idea, and I'd get frustrated because I couldn't, and I ended up throwing together a drawing at the last minute, and it wouldn't be particularly attractive or compelling. I think a compelling image really does help draw the reader in, and it enhances the impact of the editorial intent of the cartoon. And I've really put a lot more time and effort into the drawings the past few years, and it's actually, I've enjoyed the job a lot more because of that. I'm having a lot more fun with the execution and not just the creating. And ironically, I think the ideas have also gotten better because I'm having more fun.
Yeah, one thing I want to say about your drawing style is that, you know, some editorial cartoons, it's just a kind of like outline sketch of, mm-hmm. of the characters and the desk. And with yours, like, things are shaded or colored in. Mm-hmm. There's variation in black and white and gray tones. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's much more like a finished drawing than a lot of editorial cartoons.
Now, are you looking at color or black and white?
I'm looking at black and white.
Okay. I do it may be noteworthy that we've gotten color presses this year, which has invigorated my drawing style.
Oh.
And I'm doing all of these in color. I do a line drawing the way I have always done, and then I scan it into the computer, and I use a program called Painter, made by a company called Corel, that is just an amazing program, and it simulates the look of natural media, like watercolors and things like that. And I spend about 2 hours a day just in the color, and that actually, I think, can sometimes enhance the editorial impact of a cartoon. I didn't think it would at first, but I've not only enjoyed the artwork more, but can I bring up another cartoon as an example?
Sure.
It was another one in the Pulitzer package. It's "What's Wrong with This Picture" is the caption. And in one frame, the first frame, it's a soldier trying to up-armor his Humvee, and it's all shot up, and it's obviously not in very good shape. And in the next panel, it's obviously back in the United States, and there's a guy saying, "Look what I bought with my tax cut," and he's driving a bright new yellow Humvee with a "Support Our Troops" bumper sticker on it. And the color in this cartoon really enhances the editorial impact, because in the first panel you have this dusty, hot colors, oranges and yellows, and in the second panel I use sort of children's book colors, blue and yellow and green.
I'm surprised that you have color on your editorial page.
It's pretty unusual, and we did just get new presses, and they're state-of-the-art, and their color reproduction is incredible. There aren't many opportunities for cartoonists to use color in their daily papers. You know, the internet gives them the opportunity to use color if they wish, but it's nice to work in color every day.
Maybe this is naive. I also think it's interesting that instead of like drawing in the colors, that you tune that up with a software program.
Mm-hmm. And it is very similar to using real media, though. I have a tablet that in a electronic pen, and it's pressure sensitive, so I can actually look at the screen, and I'm drawing on a tablet, and I'm drawing and I'm painting with the tablet.
So I'm
not using a mouse. It's very intuitive, and it's similar to using real media, except that if you make a mistake, you can just undo it. So it's actually better. And I use watercolors, and I can do a command that makes the watercolor dry, or I can keep it wet and have the colors bleed into one another, or I can command it to dry, which you can't do. It would be impossible for me to do this with real watercolor because I wouldn't have time.
So tell us a story of how you found out that you won the Pulitzer.
Well, the finalists had been leaked out, and about 5 weeks before the Pulitzers were announced, the finalists had been leaked out. It's a two-stage process. There's a first jury that weeds it down to three people, and then the Pulitzer board picks from those three generally. And I had seen the finalist list, and I was not on it because there was a mistake by the leaker, and they said the Lexington cartoonist rather than the Louisville cartoonist. So the entire time, my friend and Lexington, who has won it before, fortunately, had taken all the anxiety of wondering whether he was going to be the winner or not, and I had no idea. And the day that they had made the announcements of who won, I hadn't even bothered to check the website to see who had won, because I figured I wasn't a factor, and I figured it was actually going to be Gary Trudeau, who most people expected was going to win this year. And then my editor's assistant starts screaming for me at around 3:15, screaming for me to get my behind down to his office. And she doesn't stop screaming. So I figure I've either done something really good or really bad. And I've walked very slowly down to his office. I've never heard her scream that way. So I didn't know what was going on, but it made me a little nervous. And I got into his office, and he greeted me as the next Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist, and I must have looked stunned because he grabbed me by the shoulder and pulled me to his computer to show me.
Is there any cartoon you would like to leave us with?
Yeah, I would like to talk about another one. And this one is I drew after George Bush gave George Tenet the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And I just thought that was outrageous. This is a guy who apparently told Bush that the WMDs in Iraq were a slam dunk, and he's getting rewarded for this. He's getting an award for this. So I actually did a cartoon that was a reference, obscure reference for most people, to a Robert Minor cartoon. It's a World War I cartoon where a German soldier is saying, "At last, the perfect soldier," and it's a huge, muscular soldier without a head. I thought that was a pretty good metaphor here. I have Bush saying, "At last, a perfect employee," and he's got the medal, and he's about to hang it around the neck of a guy without a head, and it's labeled blind loyalty, because I felt like he was rewarding Tenet for loyalty, not for performance.
Reaction to the cartoon?
Similar, you know, un-American, how dare you, that kind of thing. I get a lot of reaction that tells me I'm un-American. That's been a pretty recurring theme since September 11th, and you just have to ignore that, because dissent, there's nothing more American than dissent, in my opinion.
Well, Nick Anderson, congratulations again on your Pulitzer, and thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Talking with us.
Thanks.
Nick Anderson is the editorial cartoonist for the Louisville Courier-Journal. You can see some of his Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoons on our website, freshair.com. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the Pretty Things, a band founded by an early member of the Rolling Stones. This is Fresh Air. Some bands are obscure for a reason. They just weren't very good. Others had bad luck. The Pretty Things were in the latter category, a band spun off from the early Rolling Stones that had a lot of the same energy, but never toured the U.S. and barely even released any records here during their heyday. Rock historian Ed Ward says they're worth remembering. You can listen for yourself on a recent compilation called Come See Me, The Very Best of the Pretty Things.
The story I've always heard was that Dick Taylor was asked to leave the Rolling Stones because he was too ugly. Looking at early pictures of Bill Wyman, that's hard to believe. But it's a fact that Taylor was in a very early version of the Stones, and looking at pictures of the band Taylor formed after he left, it's clear that calling them the Pretty Things was ironic. For one thing, Taylor sported a beard, unheard of in Beatle-era rock bands, and the other four Pretty Things had more hair than any two other bands combined. signed to Fontana Records in 1963. Their first record, Rosalind, which oozed Stonesy attitude, didn't chart, but late in 1964, their second one did.
I'm on my own, just wanna roll. I tell you, man, don't want a home. I want around, be off the ground. I need to go from town to town. I say, I think this life is grand. Say, I dig it, man. Don't bring me down, man. Don't bring me down. I meant this year.
Don't Bring Me Down did pretty well, holding its own in the British top 10 against such competition as the Beatles' I Feel Fine and the Kinks' All the Day and All of the Night, not to mention the Stones' Little Red Rooster. Unlike all of those records, though, it got no attention in the United States, if it was even released at all. Instead of trying to conquer America against such daunting and well-managed competition, the Pretties did something very smart. They concentrated on continental Europe, becoming stars in places like Germany and France, and especially the Netherlands, where their anarchic stage act caused a riot in 1965. They also toured New Zealand, with the result that they are still banned from entering that country. The two central figures in The Pretty Things were guitarist Taylor and vocalist Phil May, whose rough voice was ideal for the rough music the band played. But the other musicians shifted around, particularly, no Spinal Tap jokes, please, the drummers. Taylor and May wrote most of the singles, usually with a third band member, and so there was no distinctive Pretty Things songwriting, which is not to say that there were no good songs.
I've never seen the people I know in the bright light of day. So how can I say you're any friend of mine?
See you anytime.
I'm feeling fine.
Midnight to six.
Well, that's my time.
That's your time.
Midnight to Six Man, which hit the British charts in the summer of 1966, was their last chart single there, which is no wonder, because The Pretty Things, like a lot of other bands, were, as they said back then, going through changes. Wink, nod. What could be funnier than a song about money, referencing the British symbols for pound, shilling, and pence, or L, S, and D, especially in 1966. But it was typical of the Pretty Things' attitude. They probably knew it'd never get on the radio, but what did they care? As for the other kind of LSD, they turned out to be pretty good at psychedelic music, too.
Sitting alone on a bench with you, mirrored above me. Wondering if you will say goodnight, leave me a grave of goodbye.
Reflecting Grey came out at the height of British psychedelia, 4.5 minutes of bizarre juxtaposition of sitars, screaming guitars, fey vocals, and moaning bass. It also points out another factor that may have held the Pretties back. Their sound was technically awful. From their first record, the engineering gave them a thin, anemic sound which couldn't have helped. But they weren't through trying to make people listen. Phil May had an idea he wanted to try out, and in 1968, the band released an album called SF Sorrow, a rock opera whose songs all connected. Pete Townsend of The Who heard it and realized something like that could work. With typical Pretty's luck, SF Sorrow was released in America on a subsidiary of Motown.
You might be the loneliest person in the world. You'll never be as lonely as me. Yes, you might be the loneliest person in the world. You'll never be as lonely as me. Oh, the sky, it seems dark as I'm walking through a park, but the face, it is too bright to see. Oh, the sun might rise high on an orange kind of sky, but the day, it seems too dark for me. Yes, you might be the loneliest person in the world. You'll never be as lonely as me. Yes, you might be the loneliest person in the world. Your name, it would have to be me.
After that, the Pretty Things story gets confusing, with Dick Taylor leaving the group and a version of the band turning up in the mid-70s on Led Zeppelin's record label, after which Taylor rejoined, or maybe not. Their legacy, however, lived on in the countless German, Dutch, and Scandinavian bands they inspired, and today they tour from time to time, revered as originators of grungy garage rock, progenitors of punk, and a band that never really got its due.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Letters from the Hive, An Intimate History of Bees, Honey, and Humankind by Stephen Buckman with Banning Repplier. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
AQ Khan is the father of Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. He sold nuclear technology and information to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. Khan is now under house arrest in Pakistan. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his impact on nuclear proliferation with David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.